slippers on shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another episode of the Every Outfit Podcast. Do I sound out of breath?
Kind of.
I had to run upstairs and start recording because we finally have the Sarah Jessica Parker jalapeno wine. And yes. Chelsea almost sipped it, but we had to sip it on air for the first time so you guys could hear.
Yes, this is the In Vivo Sarah Jessica Parker jalapeno wine. The nice folks at In Vivo sent this to us. Just because it's gifted doesn't mean that I won't be honest about this wine. I will say I'm a little scared about the jalapeno element, but I have an open mind.
We should also say that we are recording this in the late morning at a time that one does not typically drink wine.
Yes, 11 a.m.
But we are committed to this job.
Yes.
Okay,
all right.
Chelsea.
Bottoms up.
Cheers. Okay.
The jalapeno is not as pronounced as I expected based on the marketing. I wouldn't even know, actually. Okay, it has a little kick.
It does.
But it's not like it's like a spicy marg or something.
No, it has a little bit of a kick. Do you think that this is going to be Sarah Jessica Parker's next venture? Hot wines? Hot wines and even hotter questions.
Oh, God. Wait, let me try it. Okay, let me have some more.
All right, second sips. She's good. She's refreshing.
Okay, now I'm disappointed that the finish isn't that spicy.
You think it should be hotter?
I think it should be hotter. I think if we're going to do this, like, let's fucking do this.
The jalapeno is actually too subtle, in your opinion.
Yeah.
Also, now I'm on Sarah Jessica Parker's side, because when we first discussed this wine, it was through, I think it was Wine Spectator, did a video feature, and the woman interviewing Sarah Jessica Parker was like, this would make a great spritz, and she put grapefruit in it, and Sarah Jessica Parker was like, I just like to have it as is. And you know what? She's right. This is delightful.
You could turn it into a spritz if you wanted to. I don't know if I would add so many garnishes, though.
I think it's good on its own, and dare I say, a good wine to have on a weekday. Late morning or cocktail hour, whatever you prefer. Thank you to the folks at In Vivo for sending us the Sarah Jessica Parker jalapeno wine. I feel like it's Every Outfit approved.
I don't know if I could do this regularly.
Oh, no. I mean, that's why she has the Pinot Noir, the Chardonnay, the Sauvignon Blanc.
The low alcohol wines as well, lest we forget.
So yeah, I think the jalapeno wine is a fun thing to bring to a party.
Oh, for sure. If you're going to some gay guy's house with a sense of humor, they'd probably appreciate that you brought this.
Or your Sex in the City trivia night. They would get a kick out of the SJP X In Vivo jalapeno wine.
Okay. Moving on, we have some remake news this week. Lots of remakes on the horizon.
Indeed. Where would you like to start?
I want to start with this new Amazon series that is a remake of Carrie, the Stephen King book turned Brian De Palma film that has spawned many remakes, many sequels, TV movies, all sorts of shit over the years. The new version of Carrie is an 8-episode limited series that is coming out on Amazon. It stars Summer H. Howell, who, are you familiar with her?
I am not. To be fair, I did think this was Sadie Sink at first.
Totally. This is the poor man's Sadie Sink for sure. She looks to be an emerging scream queen based on her IMDb credits. The creator and showrunner is Mike Flanagan, who's made a lot of horror movies, none of which I have seen.
And horror series. He's sort of the horror king of Netflix.
Right. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing.
Well, what I find so interesting is that Mike Flanagan has done very well of establishing his own name in horror. It's just interesting that he's using all of that clout to be like, you know what, I want to remake Carrie, which arguably already has a perfect interpretation in the Sissy Spacek Brian De Palma version.
Totally. But it is one of those things where because there's a book, you can always go back to the source material and do something that is more aligned with the book, less aligned with the Brian De Palma film, which we see a little bit of in the trailer, because in the book, Carrie, she doesn't just like murder everyone at prom, spoiler alert, she also destroys the entire town. And it seems as though she's doing that in this series.
Right, but it is curious because the whole point of Carrie in the novel is she's a social outcast because she's overweight, she's described as chubby, and has terrible hygiene and acne, and they seem to keep casting thin, conventionally attractive women as Carrie.
No, I'm with you. That's the problem with all of these movies. And with Sissy Spacek, she is attractive, but not conventionally attractive. Like, she's weird looking.
Sure, but it is odd that Drew Barrymore as Josie Grossi and Never Been Kissed is a more accurate Scream depiction of Carrie than any of the Scream portrayals of Carrie.
Totally. Because the last Carrie that we got was the Kimberly Pierce remake of the Brian De Palma film starring Chloe Grace Moretz. Way too hot to be Carrie. What are we doing here?
When was that? 2016?
Feels like it was like a decade ago. I like that they did bring in a female director to tackle this particular subject matter. I mean, obviously, Brian De Palma did a fantastic job. The book is written by a man, but I think a woman would have unique insight into, like, how fucked and evil young girls can be. It's a really specific thing, and it's not something that you can really understand unless you've witnessed it on some level.
Or unless you're Bo Burnham, because when I was watching this trailer, I was reminded of seeing Eighth Grade and that whole pool party scene. If you remember, I was like, oh, this is how you do a modern interpretation of Carrie.
Totally. And when this project was first announced, the little girl from Hereditary was rumored to be Carrie. And I thought that was the most genius thing I've ever heard.
It is increasingly difficult, and I'm going to sound like an old man screaming at the sky, but like, it is hard to make a Carrie series with people who have Instagram face.
Totally.
Look, do I personally need a Carrie series for the social media age? No. Do I think that contemporary 15-year-olds are starting Instagram accounts about the outcast getting her period? I don't think so. At the very least, it'd be on TikTok.
It does suck, though, that you can't make a limited series or a big budget movie that is framed around a woman that isn't conventionally attractive. You can do it with an independent film, like when I think about something like Welcome to the Dollhouse or something. But can you imagine what Welcome to the Dollhouse would have been like if it was like some Elle Fanning ass bitch in that role? No, it has to be someone weird looking. Because when the character is weird looking, it also really heightens the cruelty of the bullying, you know? And that's what Carrie is about. Cruelty.
Well, that's what I find so puzzling about these remakes that we're going to talk about. And I do think that this is a great transition to start discussing the Possession remake, which is done by Parker Finn. Parker Finn, who wrote and directed Smile, is doing a remake of Andrzej Zwalski's 1981 film that starred Sam Neill, RIP, and Isabella Gianni. And I was a defender of this film when it first got announced. Only to myself, no one asked me my thoughts until now about the Possession remake. I was a defender of the idea of remaking this film, which up until a few years ago was very difficult to see.
I haven't seen it since like college, so I wouldn't know.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I saw it from like a torrent that an old boyfriend got when I was in college as well. Like, the only way that you were able to see Possession up until maybe 2 or 3 years ago was buying a European DVD for $150 on eBay.
That's crazy because I also feel like that's one of those movies that looms really large on Tumblr.
Oh yeah, no, that's why I'm like, I thought it was a good idea to remake this film because a lot of people, or shall I say, chronically online people have seen it through GIFs or the tiny clip of Isabella Gianni freaking out in the train station. But I don't know how many people have seen the whole film.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, a modern interpretation of like a surreal horror-tinged divorce story is interesting. And then I saw the first photos of Margaret Qualley, who of course has more than a passing resemblance to Isabella Gianni.
Yeah, I was impressed when I saw the photos. You weren't?
Well, I'm like, okay. She's dressed quite dowdy. She's dressed like she's in a period piece. I'm like, what are we doing here?
I was impressed. I think this is as good as you can do casting-wise, trying to remake a film. They both have real Instagram face, you know, natural Instagram face.
Yes, people get work done to look like the two of them.
Yeah.
I am thrilled to have Casper back as a sponsor of our podcast. Casper makes reliable, high-quality mattresses designed to deliver consistent, comfortable sleep night after night. Casper's mattresses are highly rated by Consumer Reports, and out of 99 mattresses, Consumer Reports named Casper's The One Mattress their top-rated all-foam mattress of 2026. I was first introduced to Casper through their dog bed. I had one for each of my dogs, and they loved it. Now I've graduated to my own Casper mattress, and I can say I don't know what I was doing with my life before Casper. I have the dream, and the name says it all. It's a hybrid mattress that helps solve tossing and turning, which is a huge issue in my own marital bed. Paul loves to toss and turn, which wakes me up. It's a whole thing, but our new mattress pairs responsive springs with ergonomic support zones, so the dream keeps you aligned and dreaming all night. Casper offers a wide range of mattress types, so whether you like your mattress firm, soft, or somewhere in between, there's something for you at Casper.com. If you've been talking about getting a new bed, now is the time with Casper's back-to-school sale. Head to Casper.com and save up to 20% on the mattress you deserve. Casper's mattresses are built to be durable and long-lasting, so you're not replacing your mattress every few years. Their products are designed to withstand the test of time, maintaining support and comfort over the long haul. I can attest, I only bought a new Casper dog bed with my second dog because I gave my first one to Chelsea. And Casper has their 100-night risk-free trial, so you can give Casper's mattresses a try risk-free. Although with 110,000 plus 5-star reviews, I'm sure you're going to love it like I do. The day always ends well with Casper. Right now, save up to 20% on mattresses and up to 25% off on everything else when you go to Casper.com. One last time. That's Casper.com and save up to 20% on the mattress you deserve. Here's my thing. Mike Flanagan, Parker Finn have established themselves as original voices in horror. I don't understand why they need to remake these beloved things that are never going to be as good as the novel, or you'll have people comparing it to the original. Like, just make your own version of Possession, or like your homage to it, which I guess a remake is, but I don't know. I've never understood the concept of remaking things. I understand it from a studio perspective, where it's like, you need to have, I guess in their mind, it's like, if people already know about the movie, then you have to do less with marketing.
Totally. But it also creates a situation where there's a built-in framework to judge the remake against that wouldn't exist if it was just an original work.
Yeah. Make your own horror-tinged divorce film that people can be like, oh, it's inspired by Possession. Look, they cast Margaret Qualley.
You've made this point many times on the podcast, but like,
so I should shut the fuck up about
it. No, but we need to be remaking mediocre movies that had great premises that were not well executed. That's what we need to do, because there is the name recognition, but there's also the opportunity to improve upon the source material.
And in the Sam Neill role seems to be Mr. Dua Lipa, Callum Turner, aka the guy in that romantic comedy that we've been waterboarded with the trailer for, where single people can only have sex one night a year.
Right, it's like The Purge, but the Sex in the City version.
Has anyone else been waterboarded with this trailer? I feel like if you've seen a movie in the last 2 months, that trailer has appeared before it.
Oh, it's what pops up in my mind when my eyes close and I drift off to sleep at night. I am excited that friend of the show King Princess is in this movie.
Oh, yeah. I love the idea of King Princess being the friend of role.
Yeah.
In a rom-com. I mean, I'm not going to see the movie, but I am going to be livid if the whole thing is that the two of them don't fuck because they fall in love and respect each other too much.
Okay, well, now I think we need to watch it.
All right.
I watched The Odyssey for you. You can watch, what is this movie called?
One Night Only?
One Night Only.
I guess job not well done, because we've seen this trailer 25 times and we're like, what is it called again?
Okay. Another, not a remake, but a prequel series has happened.
When you put this on the docket, because we were talking about the Carrie remake and the Possession remake, I did for a good 30 seconds think that Amazon had greenlit a prequel series about the 2018 Isabelle Huppert film Elle.
Which would have made sense given the very dark backstory of that character in her childhood.
But no, this is a prequel sequel to Legally Blonde, which we previously have talked about on the podcast, where a teenage Elle Woods is a fish out of water in mid-90s Seattle.
Yes.
Which, when you originally explained this to me, I thought was an incredibly dumb idea. However, now having watched the pilot, which I was very charmed by.
Okay, interesting. Can't wait to hear more.
The reason that they end up in Seattle is quite funny and works for the world, which is Elle Woods' parents, played by June Diane Raphael and Tom Everett Scott. Always great to see him on screen. Her father is a plastic surgeon who botched an unnamed actress's nose. And so he has to flee Los Angeles and can only get a job in Seattle.
Right.
I thought that was funny. That worked.
Totally. And I like the origin story stuff. Like, oh, this is where she gets the chihuahua and, you know, that sort of shit. But my issues are this. Why does every prequel automatically have to be a young adult series? This happened with the Carrie Diaries also. If anything, shouldn't they gear these towards, like, older people, like the original audience, which was more millennials and Gen X? It could still be about Elle Woods in high school, but it could just be a little grittier, perhaps. Just a thought. Not that Legally Blonde was gritty, but I guess more adult. Because I feel like I'm watching a children's show.
You do bring up a good point, because I did wonder who the audience for this is, because you are correct. It does feel like a CW show meant for Gen Alpha teens, but I don't know if anyone but the original audience for Legally Blonde would enjoy it. And you are correct. The story is not engaging to people our age.
Totally. Don't get me wrong, I hate myself, so I'll probably continue watching it, but just a thought.
Well, here's my issue with these prequel sequels, is they inevitably end up invalidating the source material, because in creating a prequel that takes place after the original film, for the original audience members, there's a lot of stuff that rings true from Legally Blonde, right? Elle is a fish out of water at Harvard. Now she's a fish out of water in Seattle. And so it's just weird, because then it makes you go back and wonder why the Elle in Legally Blonde doesn't say to Jennifer Coolidge, like, you know, this experience at Harvard reminds me a lot of the 2 years I spent in Seattle.
Yeah, true. I will say the lead is fantastic. I don't know what her name is, this actress, but they did a great job of casting Elle Woods.
Do you think that Reese Witherspoon's own daughter, who is a young adult herself, was mad that she was not cast?
I did think about that.
I have no idea if she auditioned, if she wants to be an actress, but it's got to be hard to see someone else who has a striking resemblance to your mother play a younger version of your mother.
Yeah, she has the physical resemblance, but also she really nailed the mannerisms and is doing an incredible Reese Witherspoon impression.
Her name is Lexi Mindtree, and wouldn't you know it, Chell, she was in a 2024 episode of Law & Order Special Victims Unit. It is season 26, episode 1, Fractured, Elodie Whitford. The SVU investigates a brutal attack on a group of law students. Benson hopes the discovery of a hidden camera will crack the case open.
Don't remember that one, but definitely watched it. Also, I want to say this. If this show is set in the 90s, then why do these characters occasionally dip into internet speak? Like, why are they talking about gay rights and gay wrongs? It's 1995.
This is your point of, like, committing to an elder millennial Gen X audience.
It's more just like, it doesn't feel period specific to me.
Well, no, half of the actresses that play Elle's friends have fillers.
Yeah. And look, I've only watched the first few episodes, but like the popular girl at the school feels more like a current day online social justice warrior than a 90s activist type.
I do see what you're saying. And they did have a problem. Like, the remake of 21 Jump Street deals with this quite well. When Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum have to go back to high school, the high school dynamics are completely flipped in the 2010s. Like, what would have been the ostracized art theater kids are now the popular kids.
Right.
And this show almost has the opposite problem of, like, okay, even though this is a grungified Seattle, there are still popular girls. But these popular girls talk about Bikini Kill. That was a joke. Yes. That felt like it was for us.
Oh, for sure.
That was equivalent to in Clueless when Christian goes, do you like Billie Holiday? And she goes, I love him.
Yeah. Look, I think that if you're going to set something in the 90s, I just don't want it to look like today. I want it to look like the 90s. I don't think it's that hard.
Well, clearly
it is.
Well, no, now I'm... this In Vivo wine is hitting me, Chelsea. What is our what is our beloved show on Showtime? I want to say Yellowstone. Yellow Jackets.
Okay, yes. Yellowstone, yes. That's it.
Yellow Jackets does that quite well in the casting and the filming.
Yeah.
Of something that feels authentically 90s.
Totally. Well, also, I know that this show is not cheap to make because the needle drops are like hugely popular songs. The locations that they secure, even just for like a 30-second phone call scene when like Elle calls her friend who's still in Los Angeles, it's like she's at the Beverly Hills Hotel. She's in front of the arc light.
I'm back to talk about Cash App. From getting paid to growing what you've got, Cash App makes managing your money effortless and instant without all the fees. It's the way money should work. If you didn't already know, Cash App is way more than just a safe way to send and receive money. With the Cash App card, you unlock a ton of perks without all the hidden fees. Enjoy benefits like exclusive early access to nationwide concert presales. Think Kendrick Lamar and Sabrina Carpenter, to name a couple recent examples. Plus discounts on everyday purchases and popular brands you're probably already spending money on. Add your card to your digital wallet to make your money moves easier. And then there's Cash App's new status program for the way people actually spend, called Cash App Green. It unlocks new ways for you to pay, get rewarded, and easily grow or manage your money on your terms. Now when you spend at least $500 a month with the Cash App card, you earn green status, which unlocks benefits like up to $200 of free overdraft coverage. If you overdraft unexpectedly, there are no hidden fees. You also unlock higher borrow limits and custom personalized cashback offers every Friday at places you love to shop. And best yet, if you direct deposit at least $300 in paychecks each month and use the Cash App card for purchases, you can earn interest on your savings. No hidden fees, no minimum balance requirements. Also, you can hit your savings goals even faster by turning on roundups on your Cash App card. With roundups, every purchase you make using the card is rounded up to the nearest dollar, and that spare change is automatically put into your savings. Don't let your money sit around and gather dust. Make it work for you. Take advantage of interest savings on Cash App today. New Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use code CASHAPP10 in their profile at signup and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners. Prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC. Cash App Visa debit flex cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC. And the Bancorp Bank N.A. pursuant to a license from Visa USA Inc. See terms and conditions for the Sutton prepaid card, Sutton debit flex card, and Bancorp debit flex card. Cash App Green features savings, direct deposits, roundups, overdraft coverage, and discounts provided by Cash App. A Block Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures. So speaking of things that are certainly made for our age group, it was just announced that there will be a Clueless sequel series with Alicia Silverstone coming to us on Paramount Plus. So I guess I got to revive my Paramount Plus subscription. This project was originally set up at Peacock in early 2025, but it was reported in April 2026 it was no longer moving forward. That seemed to pass us by. But Paramount Plus has given the show a 6-episode order. It is slated to begin production in LA.
Six episodes? That's not encouraging.
But at least it's filming in LA and they don't have to go to Vancouver.
Sure, but I imagine that these like executives are signing off on these 6 episodes like with a gun to their heads practically. Pretty soon it's going to be like a 3-episode series order.
They're going BBC, 4 episodes, and it takes 7 years for the second season to come on air. Okay, do you want to hear the log line?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Tell me the log line.
Beloved Beverly Hills icon Cher Horowitz has figured out a lot. She's successful in business and has mastered motherhood. That is until her daughter's high school years. And Cher finds that parenting a teenager makes her feel clueless all over again. I'm out.
Yeah, I don't know if we need to involve Alicia Silverstone in this way. Just do it with teenagers in the 90s, with a new cast.
Then we have Elle, which we just spent the last 5 minutes bitching about. I talked about this last week. My issue is...
But Elle could be good if it was made by someone that, like, cared about things. You know what I mean?
And Clueless could be good if they took out the daughter plotline. I talked about this last week with the 5-Star Weekend and Widow's Bay. Enough of these teenage storylines when there are people of a certain age. Just make Clueless the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, but a fictionalized version of it. That's all I need.
Yeah.
I don't need Cher actively being a parent. I can handle her passively being a parent in the way that, you know, Charlotte York was passively a mother in And Just Like That.
Yeah. Look, it's possible to remake something and do a good job. It happened with the Babysitter's Club series. May that show rest in peace.
Oh, wow. That unlocked something in my mind.
That was a great show.
That was quite good.
Like, a Clueless reboot series shouldn't be like an automatically cursed and doomed thing. And it's alarming that it is, especially because we are such huge fans of all of these things that are being remade.
We've been burned before, Chell.
Like, our personalities are what they are because we watched Carrie and Clueless when we were quite young, in middle school.
Sometimes as a double feature. Sometimes we force our friends to watch these movies back to back at sleepovers, scarring them for life. Just me?
Also, wait. So is no one major in the Piper Laurie role in the Carrie remake? I guess not, or we would know.
Mike Flanagan often casts his wife or partner in a lot of his roles. Let me see.
Because, like, that's the role in Carrie that, like, you could get, like, a nomination for, in theory. It was Julianne Moore in the Kimberly Pierce version.
Oh, yeah.
There was a weird, like, made-for-TV movie in the, like, I think in the early 2000s, maybe it was the late 90s that I remember watching, and it was Patricia Clarkson in the Piper Laurie role, which was major, obviously.
It's Samantha Sloyan, who has been in Midnight Mass and Hush, which are past Mike Flanagan projects.
Hush, not to be confused with that incredible movie with Gwyneth Paltrow and... was it Jessica Lange?
Yes. Also, not to be confused with one of the best Buffy episodes where no one can speak the entire episode. Or most of the episode. I don't want to get comments about it.
Okay. Moving on. Shall we get into The Odyssey?
Which, by the way, I didn't force you to see. You were like, next week we're going to talk about The Odyssey.
Well, I realized, like, I have to see it. Because to not see it, it means I won't understand, like, award season.
You won't understand award season. You won't understand current meme culture. Because somehow this film has already been memeified.
Yeah. Look, I wasn't hyped to see it based on the trailer. Did I enjoy myself? Absolutely yes. It's weird because I went in thinking that I didn't really know or remember the story. And then when I was watching it, like, all of my memories from grade school came rushing back to me. I was like, right, the Cyclops. Like, oh, right, the whole bow stringing situation.
What kind of elementary school did you go to?
Did you not learn about the Odyssey? I feel like you would have learned about that in what, like, seventh grade, eighth grade, maybe?
Like junior high.
Yeah.
I will say, I definitely feel like I got my money's worth. You and I were like ships passing in the night because unbeknownst to each other, we saw this film within 30 minutes of each other. You went to a, I would say, cursed 9:30 a.m. screening.
Yeah, there were like two other people in the theater and I was judging them. I was like, why would anyone do this? Because for us, sometimes just when you fuck up your schedule, it creates a situation where you can only see The Odyssey at 9:30 on a Tuesday, which is what I did. But these other people, like, what's their excuse? Maybe they have podcasts also.
Yeah, I mean, you had a lunch engagement. Due to my childcare situation, I often have to go to 10 a.m. screenings, which is the one I was at the Groves IMAX Theater, which made me very confused because I had not seen The Odyssey previously because I had been waiting for the TLC IMAX theater screening to open up, which had sold out weeks in advance. And lo and behold, I ended up in an IMAX. This is one of the many controversies of this film, is the many different formats, because this is the first film shot entirely on IMAX. I'm going to be very boring IMDb for a minute, if you'll allow me, Chell.
No, that's great, because I know literally nothing about this movie.
The making of this movie.
Yes.
Well, Christopher Nolan has been dabbling in IMAX since The Dark Knight or The Dark Knight Rises. They're very large cameras. And so previous to this, with every film, he's been shooting more and more sequences, usually action sequences on IMAX. This is the first film entirely shot on IMAX, which involved a lot of rigging, basically, because the IMAX camera itself is so loud that they had to build a box around it so that actors could actually have dialogue scenes with each other.
Right.
But because the camera's so large, they had to do a mirror system because an actor needs to stand to do their dialogue when they're not on camera. It would mess up the eye line. So they had to put a mirror next to the IMAX camera. And that's what the actor looks at to keep the eye lines correct.
What could be more natural than that?
Speaking of which, they have to reload the film every 3 minutes.
That's horrible. Imagine doing any task in 3 minute increments.
I mean, that's why he had to cast Anne Hathaway. You need a professional theater kid to be able to hold that level of emotion while the camera's being reset every 3 minutes.
Totally. And I want to talk about her performance specifically because there was not a ton of camp value in The Odyssey apart from her. And the performance confused me because she was good, but she also didn't disappear into the role in the way that a lot of the other actors did. And also she overacted, but it worked. Very confusing.
This episode is brought to you by IQBar, our exclusive snack, hydration, and coffee sponsor. IQBar protein bars, IQ Mix hydration mixes, and IQ Joe mushroom coffees are the delicious low-sugar brain and body fuel you need to win your day. You've heard me talk about IQBar before. I love everything they have going on. The IQBar themselves, they're the smarter snack choice with plenty of plant protein, tons of fiber, and no added sugar. My favorite flavor currently is the lemon blueberry, and I keep them in my car on the off chance I or my passenger get hangry. And guess what? Earlier this week, my mom was with me in the car and she was feeling a bit peckish. She had the lemon blueberry IQ bar and said it tasted just like a blueberry muffin. Their IQ mix is a zero sugar drink mix that hydrates with electrolytes, improves mood, and boosts clarity. I love their yuzu mango flavor, which was a collaboration with Michelin star chef Thomas Keller. All IQ bar products are clean label certified and entirely free from gluten, dairy, soy, GMOs, and artificial ingredients. They may be a sponsor of this podcast, but I genuinely use IQ bar in my daily life. Do I use my own promo code when I buy my IQ bar order? Of course, and you should too. And right now, IQ bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% off all IQ bar products, including the ultimate sampler pack, plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text OUTFIT to 64000. Text OUTFIT to 64000. That's OUTFIT to 64000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details.
Look, as a Christopher Nolan fan, it has all the hallmarks of a Christopher Nolan film. You either got to take it or leave it, right? You're going to get expansive, luscious visuals and jaw-dropping locations. You're going to get heady ideas delivered through underbaked dialogue. If there are women in the film, not always a guarantee with a Christopher Nolan film, but you can be guaranteed they won't have much of an interior life and they're not going to pass the Bechdel test. And
oh yeah, she really doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Odysseus this, Odysseus that. Bitch, get a life. It's been 20 years.
Think of all the women in the film. Calypso? Obsessed with Odysseus.
Wait, that's Charlize, right?
That is Charlize in her own Dior, J'adore Dior ad.
In her asymmetric netted gown.
Yeah.
It was very J'adore Dior. I felt like I was like going through security at the Tom Bradley terminal, you know, when they subject you to all of those giant Dior ads.
Of course. I do feel like Bernard Arnault was maybe like, hey, can we maybe get some of that B-roll? Like, we'll pay you for it.
Okay, but that was like the best and most chill place in the Odyssey. Like, I would have just stayed there eating the lotus flowers with that bitch indefinitely.
Right, which has been some of the criticism of where Christopher Nolan has diverted from the original material, because there is no sex in pretty much any Christopher Nolan film. There's hardly feelings, right? Feelings are not as much felt in Christopher Nolan films as they're just sort of reasoned about for several hours. But Calypso, the subtext is she has raped him for 7 years.
Right. It's giving like Rohypnol, actually.
Yeah.
You're right. I wasn't looking at that through the correct lens.
By the way, why would you, the way that Christopher Nolan has presented it? You're like,
this sounds great.
Well, she is presented as basically his therapist. And the Rohypnol that he has taken through the lotus flower for the last 7 years was more for rehabilitation.
Right, like ketamine therapy.
Yeah, and not for like date rape reasons.
Wow. Mind blown.
Can I blow your mind a little bit more before we get into the details of this film? Did you notice there was not one but two Sex and the City / And Just Like That related characters in the film, or actors in the film?
Did not notice. Who?
James Remar, who was in Oppenheimer.
Wait, who the fuck was he?
By the way, can I just say I'm proud that I didn't say Richard Remar yet again?
I'm proud of you too.
When he goes down to Hades, James Remar is the character who's like, drink the blood and I'll tell you the prophecy.
Holy shit. Was his dick out again?
It wasn't, because again, these movies are sexless.
Okay, who's the other?
Logan Marshall Green, who was Adam Gardner, Seema's love interest, is Robert Pattinson's right-hand man, the one who can't fight, who's fighting with Tom Holland at the end.
Seema's love interest that was also the Prada sales guy?
No, no, no. Seema's love interest who did Carrie's backyard.
Oh, okay. Yes. Right. Him.
He's also in this movie.
Well, there you go. I'm glad one of us is on top of it.
What if I was like, Evan Handler's in the film? You didn't notice?
Look, there's so many people in this film. A lot of them are wearing helmets. It's a bit confusing.
I mean, most specifically, Benny Safdie as Agamemnon.
Which I also didn't clock that.
Well, you were too busy clocking the Schiaparelli-inspired helmet, I assume.
It was very Schiaparelli overall.
Which has been another controversy of this film, which is a lot of historians have been like, it's not historically accurate. It's like, okay, but it looks cunt, so.
What, like the Cyclops isn't historically accurate? What are they talking about? Or do they mean the clothes?
The clothes are not period specific.
Who gives a shit? Certainly not me. I care about the 90s, but not the, when does this take place, allegedly?
The BCE. Here's the whole thing.
What, the BCE? The, before what?
Okay. 12th century BCE.
Wait, before Christ? Does Christ exist in the same world as, like, these Greek gods and shit?
No. Think about what you just said. Clearly
that's,
not.
That's exactly why I'm trying to get clarification on when exactly this took place.
Right, but Homer wrote this in the 8th century BCE, which is technically afterwards. We're getting closer to when Christ existed.
Okay, but what does BCE stand for?
Oh my God. This episode brought to you by Google. BCE stands for Before the Common Era. It is a secular and religiously neutral alternative to BC, before Christ.
Okay, so it's the PC way to say before Christ, but it's the same exact line in the sand.
You are correct. This is also Homer's fantasy of what he thinks that era was like. One, people aren't even sure if the Trojan War happened, if there was a woman named Helen, if there was even a Homer.
Right.
Anyway, welcome back to Idiots Explain the Odyssey to you.
Sorry, if people are saying that the costumes are historically inaccurate, I want to at least know what period we're talking about.
You are correct. Another person who had a lot of issues with this film is a woman named Emily Wilson, who wrote a 4,000-word review on the Odyssey. She wrote what is now the best-selling translation of the Odyssey. It is described as, like, the woke translation of the Odyssey.
Okay.
Which, instead of saying servant, she says slaves. And on the press tour, Christopher Nolan has said repeatedly that her translation directly inspired the Odyssey. So imagine her dismay when she saw it and she was like, oh, this movie sucks.
Well, what specifically did she take issue with? As someone that is not super familiar with the original text.
Well, I did the work. I read all 4,000 words. What people have clipped out is sort of this section where she goes, the writing is abysmal. None of the characters have convincing motivation for their actions or words. There are no sex scenes and all the food looks horrible.
The food did look disgusting.
I kind of think that's the point.
So, wait, this girl wanted to see Matt Damon, dick down Charlize and Anne Hathaway?
No, I mean, as she goes on to write, Nolan's Odyssey lacks many of the elements that make the poem great. It has nothing convincing to say about time, memory, history, war, or about the relationship between one hero's glorious return and the lives of his family, adversaries, comrades, friends, and neighbors. It lacks psychological, emotional, political, and ethical depth. The narrative structure is gimmicky. This is just Christopher Nolan films, and I say this as a fan of Christopher Nolan films. He makes dumb, smart people movies. He makes people care about going to the 40 IMAX 70 millimeter theaters.
Right.
We got off on talking about Charlize Theron, and I forgot to explain the different formats to you. There are only 40 theaters in the entire world that can show this film the way that Christopher Nolan intended it to be, which is the IMAX 70mm. There are IMAX theaters, that's what I went to, but I didn't go to the IMAX 70mm.
So what's the difference?
I guess the size of the screen? I'm not sure. That's certainly the difference when you see it in a 35mm screen versus the IMAX screen. But people have said that this is incredibly elitist. He has also shot the film in such wide vistas that I don't think you're missing essential parts of the film. Like, maybe you don't see the tippy top of Agamemnon's Schiaparelli ponytail helmet, but you get the idea.
Right.
But he has repopularized the IMAX format, so much so that, you know how they do the gimmicky popcorn buckets?
Mm-hmm.
The popcorn bucket for the Odyssey was an IMAX camera, which was actually pretty cute.
Is it?
If you're a cinephile, I mean, most of the popcorn buckets, it's one of those consumerist things where it like feels good in the moment. But as soon as you head home, you're like, why do I have this Dune sandworm that looks like I could stick my dick in it?
Yeah. Like, do all of you bitches still have those Devil Wears Prada handbag popcorn buckets?
That's what I'm saying. Anyway, they cannot make more IMAX projectors, Chelsea, because all the guys that made the IMAX projectors are dead or retired, and they never left blueprints. So it is quite literally a dying art.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Today's episode is brought to you by Square, the business toolkit that helps you sell, manage, and grow without the chaos. I've said it before, but it's worth repeating. Here at Every Outfit HQ, we've been using Square longer than we've had this podcast. Every time we've done a live show and sold merch, we've used Square. We truly would have been lost without it on our last tour. Square brings payments, POS, inventory, staffing, and online sales together in one system so business owners don't have to juggle a bunch of tools. Their hardware and software are designed to be easy to use so day-to-day operations feel simpler. Square works whether you're just starting out or growing from one location to many. You can sell online, in-store, or both, and customize your setup as your business evolves. It's built to support different kinds of businesses, whether you're a podcast, a salon, or a restaurant, not force everyone into the same mold. Square now offers three clear plans: free, plus, and premium, so you can pick the tools you need and grow into more when you're ready. Did you know sellers who use Square software see 9% higher sales on average? My favorite part about Square is they offer simple, transparent pricing with flexible plans that grow with your business. That means no hidden fees, locked-in contracts, upcharges for premium cards, empty promises, or surprise costs. Square helps you run your business more smoothly, bringing payments, operations, and insights together in one place so you're ready for whatever's next. Right now, listeners can get up to $200 off Square's hardware when you sign up at square.com/go/outfit. That's SQUARE.com/go/outfit. Get started with Square and build a setup that works the way you do.
We haven't even discussed Robert Pattinson, who to me is the best part of the film.
Yeah, he's the star. I was so impressed by his performance in this and his performance in the drama earlier this year. I think he's just a really magnetic, magnificent, versatile actor.
And he will be ending the year by playing Chris Hansen in this movie called Prime Time.
Can't wait for that.
I just love how convincing he is playing a really wormy guy. Like, he can be Batman and this anti-hero, and then also this character, which he said was inspired by James Wood in Casino, which, chef's kiss.
He was so charismatic that I actually wanted him to succeed. I was like, fuck Odysseus. Fuck, what's Odysseus's son?
Oh, don't make me. Tom Holland.
It seems like Robert Pattinson is more fit to be king of, where the fuck are they?
Ithaca. I agree with you. I love how we have yet to discuss the lead actor, Odysseus, who stars in this 3-hour film. We've yet to discuss Matt Damon.
I didn't realize that this was like a Matt Damon film, first and foremost. I should have, as he is Odysseus. But I didn't realize the extent of his screen time in relation to everyone else in the cast.
You thought it would be more of an ensemble?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love that.
Good for him.
I mean, he in many ways is just there.
Yeah.
He is a vessel for this story. I didn't even think about this being an award show contender, But of course it is. Like, the debate online is, are they going to try to push Anne Hathaway for Best Actress or Best Supporting Actress? Yes. What is that going to do to Samantha Morton, who is great as Cersei?
She is great, but it's going to be Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway does more than Samantha Morton. No shade to Samantha Morton. We love some Samantha Morton here on the Every Outfit podcast.
And no shade to Lupita Nyong'o, who plays not one, but two roles.
Yeah.
Two thankless roles.
Yeah, exactly. Zendaya, another thankless role, I would say. She really dominated the press tour for The Odyssey with her fabulous La Roche outfits, but in the film plays a very, very minor role.
She plays Athena, who is, if Calypso is Odysseus's therapist, she's sort of a silent therapist.
Yeah, she's just there to remind him that he's a piece of shit.
Well, you're so right. I did think that Zendaya would have a more consequential role because in the press tour, Tom Holland, who is her husband, they're now married, who plays Matt Damon's son, and tells this story where Christopher Nolan was like, I'm thinking of Zendaya as Athena. Like, would you mind telling her? Is she interested? And Tom Holland told her to look at the script again and look at Athena. She got all excited. She was like, are you serious? But now, having seen the film, it's like, what would she have looked for? She has no lines of dialogue.
Totally.
Oh, you mean this woman that just silently looks at Odysseus the entire time?
She literally just sits there and serves. Like, that's what she does. She serves, and then there's, like, moments where she serves where it's a bit sadder and more judgmental serving.
So she really does all the Zendaya emotions. Fear serving, sad serving.
All of it.
Obviously, The Odyssey is the movie of the summer. Although, I don't know if I agree, because I feel like no one's discussing it, but it's kind of the summer of Olivia Wilde.
Yes, it is. And these movies are much more up my alley from the jump.
Absolutely. We saw The Invite, and we got invited to the premiere of I Want Your Sex, which comes out this weekend. Let's start with The Invite, but I do feel like there is an overarching theme that carries through between The Invite and I Want Your Sex, which is this idea of the potential perils of a dead bedroom and how, you know, sometimes letting your freak flag fly every once in a while is good for the soul.
Totally. So The Invite is a remake of a Spanish film called The People Upstairs, which came out in 2020, which I have not seen. It was actually originally a play that was turned into a film. But that really explains the physical parameters of this movie, which is entirely set in an apartment.
Yes. And I don't know if you clock the screenwriters. It is written by Will McCormick and Rashida Jones.
Cool.
Actress, daughter of Quincy Jones and Peggy Lipton. She now has a career as a screenwriter.
That's quite cool. Good for her.
Anyway, I just thought that was a little fun IMDb trivia fact.
So the film is about two couples. It's Olivia Wilde and Seth Rogen, who are in a monogamous, sexless marriage. And they invite their neighbors over, played by Penelope Cruz and Edward Norton, who are swingers, basically.
A little more freer with their sexuality.
Yeah. As someone who has definitely gotten into an argument with their partner, like, right before hosting a dinner party, I found this film to be scarily, scarily accurate.
Yeah. If you are married, if you've been in a long-term relationship, it is hard not to see yourself in one of these characters. For me, the bickering, and Seth Rogen comes in with this collapsible bike that he can't figure out how to collapse, and his back is all fucked up, and Olivia Wilde gets on his case about just wanting to help him out. I was like, ooh, okay, I see myself a little bit in this.
Totally. It does feel very informed by Woody Allen's oeuvre and the way that his films addressed marriage and sex and the humiliating aspects of marriage and sex.
Well, Olivia Wilde has talked about how she was inspired mostly in the blocking by 12 Angry Men, but I really haven't heard her discuss how similar this film is in its architecture to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Totally. I have to assume that that was a big inspiration for this movie.
Yeah, because you have, even though the characters, all of them are contemporaries in age, where in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you have the older couple who is embittered versus the younger couple who's more idealistic. you have, just by virtue of the fact that Edward Norton and Penelope Cruz are a newer couple, they've only been together for a year, they are the more idealistic and freewheeling couple.
Yeah. I have to say, watching this movie and watching I Want Your Sex, I've always thought that Olivia Wilde was a great actor, but now I think that she's a comedic genius after seeing both of these movies.
Yeah, because she came to prominence in the show House.
Which I never watched. Did you?
My father was a huge House fan, so...
What is House about? A house?
No. his last name is House. It's House MD. No, this was at a time where everything was like, what if our character was Sherlock, but it's with medicine? What if this guy was Sherlock, but he solves crimes with math?
Okay, so which one of those scenarios is House?
House is Sherlock, and he solves medical mysteries every week.
Okay.
And she was, Olivia Wilde played one of his interns or residents who was bisexual, but she had some terminal disease.
Okay, cool.
She was also, I never watched the OC, but I guess she, her first role where people knew her was from the OC, where I think she also plays a bisexual. She couldn't show her comedic genius because she was too busy being typecast as a bisexual woman.
Right.
But she was in the Tron movies, and obviously we all know what happened with Don't Worry, Darling. But certainly she showed her personal taste with her directorial debut, Booksmart, which was very funny.
Yeah, love Booksmart.
I mean, this really shows people's parasocial relationship with celebrities, good and bad, because everyone had a good time, including us vilifying her for Don't Worry, Darling, which I stand by. You know, everyone has sort of forgiven her. I mean, she didn't need to be forgiven, but it feels like everyone is like, oh man, we really gave her too much shit. Don't Worry, Darling is not a good movie. Direction-wise, it's beautiful, but the script is bad.
Yeah, of course.
But obviously with the invite, it is a return to form. Obviously, I mean, she said as much in her Call Her Daddy interview that she is working through her own breakdown of her relationship with Jason Sudeikis, which if you remember, he served her, not divorce papers because they were not married, but some sort of like weird custody agreement she was served while she was presenting Don't Worry, Darling at CinemaCon.
Yes, I do remember that. Both of these movies that she has made are very much giving, I just got divorced, even though, like you said, she wasn't actually married, but I believe they were together for close to a decade, right?
If not longer. Yeah, they have two kids with each other.
Long enough for her to presumably read Esther Perel's Mating in Captivity.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen any interviews with her, but she's talked about Esther Perel a lot.
Well, Esther Perel was credited on this film as a consultant.
She was, yes.
Which makes sense because this movie does reflect a lot of the big picture themes in that book.
Have you read that book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you recommend?
Yeah, I would recommend. I mean, I read it a long time ago. I read it maybe like, it's been over a decade. But I thought it was a genius book at the time.
Going back to the film itself, this is hinted at, if not all but said in the trailer, is that Olivia Wilde and Seth Rogen have invited their neighbors, played by Penelope Cruz and Edward Norton, over for a get-to-know-you drinks. But Edward Norton and Penelope Cruz have their own invitation, let's say, for Seth Rogen and Olivia Wilde, which this is a tight hour and 30, hour and 40 minute movie. But I was surprised that that part of the film is really just the last 30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah, it's mostly this Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf style bickering between Seth Rogen and Olivia Wilde. I just appreciated all the actors in this movie so much because Olivia Wilde, very good at playing high-strung, stressed hostess, which is a genre of woman that I love. Seth Rogen, very much doing his classic Seth Rogen thing, which always seems to work for him, where he is a very lovable fuck-up, but we're into it anyway.
Which is funny because by all accounts, he has a wonderful, successful, happy marriage to his wife who he's been with since like the Judd Apatow days.
Yeah. He's someone that to me, I always think is a joy to watch on screen. And I also think that there's something about him, I think it's very easy for guys to project themselves into a Seth Rogen character in the way that people can project themselves into a Adam Sandler character because he does have a kind of everyman quality to him. He's not a typical leading man, but he's very charismatic.
And speaking of the Woody Allen influence, going back to Olivia Wilde's character, she does embody that Woody Allen leading woman thing where it's like she is the most beautiful woman, but like she's sexless and no one wants to fuck her.
Yeah. Penelope Cruz, incredible. So hot. So unbelievably charismatic.
And funny.
Very funny.
Which I feel like she doesn't get to do a lot in films.
No. And the dynamic with Edward Norton, very believable. Edward Norton playing a genre of swinger that I know I've seen on screen before. Like the kind of swinger guy where there's almost a new age component to the non-monogamy.
Well, this film introduced me to the phrase rolfing, which has nothing to do with sex, but is a genre of massage.
Hmm. Yeah, see, those guys are into like erotic massage, tantric sex, sting, demi, soon ye, soon me.
Penelope Cruz, another Woody Allen heroine.
Yeah.
At times I felt like she was her, oh my God, I almost said Crazy Stupid Love. I gotta say, this In Vivo SJP jalapeno wine is having quite the effect on me. I don't know if it's the wine itself or the time of day we're drinking it.
I have to say, it is hitting.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona, that's the film. At times she was giving that performance, which I think is one of her best performances. I believe she won an Oscar for that. But she plays a therapist, specifically what seems to be a sex therapist. Or she's a therapist who's also a sexologist.
Right.
Let me correct the record. But as someone who's a big fan of the show Couples Therapy, by the end of the film, there is a scene where she is sitting and the lighting of the apartment, it is giving Couples Therapy. Penelope Cruz is giving Orna.
I can see that.
So yeah, good for Olivia Wilde. This is certainly a return to form for her.
Yeah, good for her. She's making really interesting choices with her career, with her directing career, with her acting career, taking big swings. Good for her. Many people do not have the vision.
And the taste.
Yeah.
The production design, because it really is, there are four characters, one location. I did think at a certain point, like, oh, are we going to Penelope Cruz and Edward Norton's apartment? Nope. So you saying that it's originated as a play makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I want to see the people upstairs.
Oh, the original film.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on to I Want Your Sex.
It is Greg Araki's first feature film in 12 years, which I did not realize.
Wait, that's crazy. Seriously?
Yes.
So was the last one, The White Bird and the Blizzard, like the Christopher Maloney, Shane Woodley one? Because that's the last one I remember watching.
Yeah.
He had the television series, Now Apocalypse, which, like I Want Your Sex, was co-written by friend of the show Carly Shortino, friend of the show and frequent Every Outfit co-host.
And because of that, we scored invites to the premiere. So thank you, Carly, for inviting us. Before we get into the film, can we just talk about the premiere experience?
Sure.
We had a run-in with Daddy MPK.
Lovely to see him. We should have expected that he would be there because him and Greg are friends, as we've mentioned on this show before. Greg's boyfriend is named Che Diaz. That is where Michael Patrick King got the inspiration for the name of that character.
It was surreal to say the least because we got our tickets. We were deciding whether to go inside and out of the corner of my eye, I saw Daddy MPK. We should say that the attire for the event, it was suggested to come as slightly kinky. He was in all black, a black polo shirt, and a white cardigan tied around his shoulders.
I was dead at the white cardigan. So we went up to him, congratulated him on the comeback, reintroduced ourselves because we haven't seen him since we interviewed him in, what, 2018?
Yes, 2018. And some shit has gone down since then. He asked us how our page was going, referring to the Instagram. I said we had a podcast. And that was really the extent of the exchange.
Yeah, we're not sure if he knows that we have a podcast and pretended he didn't know or if he has no idea. And honestly, either scenario, I'm completely fine with.
Yeah, I mean, all of our friends who were there were very intrigued how the interaction went. And I just kept saying, like, if he wanted to go to the bar, get a drink, come back, throw it in our faces, I would have been like, you know what? Fair.
Yeah, I deserve that. Respect.
And then we didn't see him for the rest of the night.
We did see Gus Van Sant, who was also there. That's a very exciting sighting for me.
Yeah, I meant to mention that, like, in the same moment we saw Daddy MPK to the right of us, to the left of us was Gus Van Sant, and we weren't sure which of our gay fathers to go towards.
Yeah, it's like those videos I see on TikTok where two people are, like, calling their dog.
Oh.
To see. I don't know which one to go to first.
Obviously, it was Daddy MPK because we have some personal relationship to him. Gus Van Sant would have been.
No, I wouldn't just randomly accost Gus Van Sant. Love him too much to do that.
But it was great to see all of our gay fathers together in one place.
Totally. Okay, so let's get into the movie. Greg Araki's filmography has varying degrees of darkness, shall we say? I would say that this is one of his least dark offerings. It is a very funny movie. It is not super violent.
No, I'd put this, if we're talking about, like, what would we say his darkest movie is? Mysterious Skin?
Living End? I mean,
yeah, if we're
Doom Generation? Like, those ones to me are the darkest.
Yeah, if we're going to put that on the heavy end and maybe, like, Nowhere and Kaboom or somewhere in the middle, this is on the smiley face end of the Greg Araki spectrum.
I think Kaboom is also on the smiley face end of the spectrum.
This, unlike most Greg Araki films, has no UFOs in them.
Oh yeah, I didn't even think about that. Well, the last one didn't either. The Christopher Maloney one had zero aliens.
So this is a script that Greg Araki and Carly wrote 13 years ago. It's based on an experience that Carly had in her 20s with her employer. They rewrote it post-Me Too because originally it was an older guy boss and a younger female intern, and then they gender swapped it. So now you have a film where Olivia Wilde is this sex-forward pop artist and Cooper Hoffman plays her intern, who she has a dominant submissive relationship with.
Yeah, and the Olivia Wilde character is hilarious. She is very un-PC. Like, she has the attitude of a man who thinks that the Me Too movement ruined flirting and ruined sex forever. If the gender roles were reversed, I do think it would be a bit more taboo because the Cooper Hoffman character is quite young. He's playing a 21-year-old. The actor is 23.
He's 23 now. Carly told us he turned 21 on the movie.
Okay. Right. And Olivia Wilde, I believe, is playing a character in her 40s.
As she is a woman in her 40s.
Yeah.
And Cooper Hoffman is not your typical leading man in a Greg Araki film, but I can't imagine the film without him.
Yeah, he's not the typical leading man because he is not a hot mixed race twink or like a jacked gay guy.
Yeah, I feel like if Heated Rivalry had come out a few years ago, we would have seen Hudson Williams in this role.
Yeah.
But there is something about Cooper Hoffman that while I was watching the movie, I felt like Olivia Wilde. I'm like, I would have an affair with this man. Like, he does have riz.
He has a certain je ne sais quoi, but I think because he's not the typical Greg Araki leading man, it's interesting because it makes the sexcapades with Olivia Wilde a little bit more unexpected, I think. Again, not to say that he doesn't have riz, but it is a bit surprising that this man is the person that the Olivia Wilde character is sexually obsessed with.
Which makes the film all that more interesting.
We also get some fun people like Johnny Knoxville, Margaret Cho, playing cops.
Which I had not seen a trailer for this movie. I mean, I was going to watch it regardless, so I didn't need to see a trailer. But it wasn't until the premiere when all the actors came out that I learned that Margaret Cho and Johnny Knoxville were in the movie playing cops.
Yeah. And Margaret Cho had a very, very minor role in the Doom Generation, but since then she's not been in any Greg Araki movies. So I really enjoyed seeing them come back together for this. I thought it was really cute.
And I was delighted to see James Duvall return in a minor role.
Briefly.
A cameo, if you will.
We need to see him. So Greg did not use his longtime costume designer on this project. He used Ariane Phillips, presumably because she had worked with Olivia Wilde on Don't Worry, Darling.
And the invite.
And the invite. She clearly enjoys working with Olivia Wilde. But it was funny to see her do a Greg Araki type movie. Because, like, I think the costume beat in Greg's movies is often very heightened. The characters, especially if they're teenage characters, often dress in a way that is very trendy. Like in Nowhere, it wasn't like the way that teenagers dressed in the 90s. It was like a take on the way that teenagers on 90210 dressed in the 90s. So for this movie, it was fun to see her dress the Olivia Wilde character, who is this very like ridiculous conceptual artist, in this way that was very like kind of the Zoolander version of what a fashion forward, glamorous art star would dress like.
Now that you say that, I'm like, Olivia Wilde, because she has this blonde wig that she wears in the film and also wears a lot of latex. She does at times look like a female version of Mugatu.
Totally. Well, the wig is also a really important part of her transformation for this role, I think. The whole look was perfect and really funny and really cool.
I never thought about wearing latex to the office. And you know what? Olivia Wilde's really opened my mind to that. So can I get into this minor controversy, which has really just been retained to the internet, that happened with Greg Araki doing press for this film?
Sure. I must have missed this, but catch me up.
So Greg Araki, I would say pretty innocently, was giving an interview to Variety where he said that he had seen the reports that Gen Z was having less sex, and he thinks that younger people will, quote, regret not taking chances and risking getting hurt. I'm in my 60s now. You're going to turn around and you're going to be 40, 50 like that. Will you regret not taking a chance, venturing out of your house, risking getting hurt, getting confused, getting your heart broken, go out on a bad date, have that bad relationship, have that bad girlfriend, be in love with the wrong person? That's fucking life. That's growing up. That's how you learn about yourself. How could anyone have a problem with that?
Leave it to the internet.
I assume Gen Z, which what they're doing on Twitter, I don't know. But they, of course, have replied with the most bad faith takes possible. One person, the dog is my co-pilot, just posted a close-up photo of Greg and then goes, this dude who hasn't made a single relationship work in his 66 years on this planet wants Gen Z to listen to his dating advice? Does he want to teach them about technology too, first of all?
He has been with Che Diaz for a while.
Yeah. Get your facts right.
I don't know how long, but to my knowledge, at least 5 years.
You will waste time on a bad relationship. You will experience unneeded hardships because that's what happened to us. And we turned out heckin' fine. I don't know what that means. Yeah, no, we're not dealing with this bullshit anymore. We've seen where it leads. And besides, we can't afford it anymore.
You can't afford to get fucked?
Every generation is different, and the elders will always think their way was better. Maybe Gen Z will be the ones to normalize not needing a relationship to be happy or fulfilled.
Okay, well, there's some truth to that. I don't think everything in life has to be about being in a relationship. That's crazy.
What a stupid statement. 1 in 3 women are victims of intimate partner physical violence.
Well, now you've brought up intimate partner violence.
I mean, that's not what he meant by go on a bad date. Someone goes, one oopsies will have you bonded for life with the wrong person, shared custody if you're lucky. Guys, if you've ever watched a Greg Araki film, which clearly none of these people have, he is pro safe sex.
That's wild.
And really, if I want your sex is telling us anything, just peg your male partner more.
This also pisses me off because, like, respect your queer elders. You know, you don't have to agree with Greg Araki, but you also don't have to come for him.
As they say, opinions are like assholes.
But also, like, I'm sorry, like, this man is someone who is out of the closet, making films about AIDS, like, during the AIDS crisis, that has seen so much shit. His mere presence has helped to lay the foundation for you to have the societal acceptance that you enjoy today.
Well, as someone else replied, I'm too autistic to try this kind of shit. Fair enough.
Yeah, you gotta know when to call it.
But Greg said when he was introducing the film, he wanted to make something that was very fun. It is fun, as he pointed out. I mean, it's very apocalyptic times. Why do I want to see that on screen? It's a very fun romp. It's very funny. Carly and Greg's script is hilarious.
If you appreciate the bitchy tone of this podcast, you'll probably enjoy this movie, which is funny in an accessible way, but has a bit of an edge to it as well.
Yeah, it's not too serious.
And that's what I want right now. I do just want to see like a fun romantic comedy. It's not really a romantic comedy, but a comedy about some whack BDSM relationship.
Yeah, I believe Carly has referred to it as a com-dom, a dom-com.
A com girl.
A rom-dom.
The progress you made not saying Richard Remar, yeah. You've just undone with that.
I blame the In Vivo SJP jalapeno wine. We have not mentioned that Charlie XCX appears in this film as well.
She's good. She plays Cooper Hoffman's girlfriend who doesn't want to fuck him, ever, and treats him like shit.
A perfect role for Charlie XCX.
Olivia Wilde also treats him like shit, but in a way that is a bit more playful and fun.
Pushing his limits.
Yeah.
It also has podcaster representation.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Anyway, if I Want Your Sex is playing in your city or your town, go see it.
Yes, I Want Your Sex is every outfit approved. But speaking of Charlie, perfect transition into her new record, Music Fashion Film, which came out last week. What do we think?
I really enjoyed it. I think many artists who have zeitgeisty albums that would be considered a phenomenon as Brat was, take many, many years to do a follow-up, and it's always a letdown critically, commercially, compared to their previous work. So I think it's smart to release the next album quickly.
Totally. And she kind of already did that with the Wuthering Heights soundtrack, but of course that was like Heathcliff and Kathy vibes. It wasn't all about Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, this album feels like the song version of waking up the day after partying and having a hangover. Like, these are songs to be hungover to, which I feel like is an underrepresented genre.
I don't know if I want to be hungover and listen to a song like Yeah necessarily, but maybe. I like it a lot. It's not a perfect album, but it's also not trying to be a perfect album. And I like the immediacy of it. I like how fast the songs are. I like how the songs don't feel overwrought or predetermined. It feels like something that she actually wanted to make. And I was relieved that she feels that she didn't need to top Brat or make a more exaggerated version of Brat.
And I think that the album is self-aware in that way.
Totally. She's literally addressing that in some of these lyrics.
Yeah. A lot of the songs are about dealing with overnight fame. What does one do with that? What does one do next? You know, I was thinking a lot about No Doubt's Return to Saturn as a comp.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, Tragic Kingdom was a phenomenon. They released this album that is much more contemplative. It is much more about Gwen Stefani wanting to be married, contemplating having a child. A little bit darker themes compared to Tragic Kingdom.
Right. Although Charlie did have her Simple Kind of Life moment on the Brat album. It's interesting. It's like someone like Debbie Harry really created the blueprint for how does someone that is a pop vocalist make a rock album. In the years since then, we see people like Gwen Stefani, like Shirley Manson from Garbage, making music in that mold. I thought it was interesting that this album didn't remind me of that kind of music at all. To me, it seems like she drew more inspiration from like largely male rock stars for this record, with the exception of Kim Gordon, whose influence I hear throughout, but specifically on the song Card Declined. Like, she wouldn't reference a Mahjong sofa, but the production of it, the delivery of those lyrics feels very much like a Kim Gordon song.
But sonically, a lot of the songs remind me of kind of girl rock from the late 90s, early 2000s, like a Letters to Cleo or something.
Really? See, I don't get that at all. For me, I'm hearing more like on a song like Magic Metal Montana. To me, that's a very like Julian Casablancas type vocal performance.
Right.
Camera, which is a song that I really like, it kind of reminds me of Phoenix almost, or those kinds of songs.
I feel like songs like 2007 and I mean, yeah, as well. But it's funny to, I don't know if you've read the reviews of this album, but I also think specifically she made an album where it's not a complete departure from Brat. Like 2007 is a very catchy song, but there are more contemplative, sadder songs like I'm Afraid.
Yeah. I'm Afraid almost reminds me of, like, the sound of it is not emo or not pop punk, but it does also remind me of Adam's Song by Blink-182.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Not the whole song, but just the how she begins the song, shall we say.
I think people have taken issue with the vocals, the lyrics, the instrumentation, that it all feels unfinished. But I think that's purposeful. I don't think she's trying to get out of a record contract so she, you know, quickly put out another album. I think very purposely so, the songs are unpolished as an artistic choice.
Which, in a way, is a return to form for her, because that was very much what her pandemic album, How I'm Feeling Now, was about. The very, like, quick record that, again, didn't feel overwrought. And I think it's cool. I love that she has taken this particular approach, because you can't replicate Brat. Brat was successful because of a combination of musical choices, leaning into dance music, club music, obviously marketing choices, and then also the element of Brat where it was like the conversation around who these songs are about. This song is about Lorde. This song is about Taylor Swift. This album has less of that, although it does have one song like that, which is Persona.
Is that about Taylor?
Well, people believe it to be about Sky Ferreira, but people have also said that it could be about Rina Sawayama. People have discussed Lorde, although I do not think that's likely at all. But basically, it's a song that is clearly written about a peer in the industry with whom Charlie shares certain qualities. It is a Ingmar Bergman reference to the film Persona, about sort of merging identities and projection and stuff like that. This is my favorite song on the record. And it's a rare record where I like the last songs more than the first songs or the middle songs. Like, to me, the peak of the album is the last four songs.
Well, speaking of the last song, it features David Cronenberg, which makes me wonder, why isn't David Cronenberg on the cover instead of Martin Scorsese?
Less recognizable, I guess, although John Cale isn't physically recognizable to a ton of people at this point.
It was just surprising to me when I saw the Cronenberg credit, where I'm like, then why isn't he the movie part of the cover? She's talked a lot about Cronenberg's influence on her.
Well, I think it would be a little too extreme to have Cronenberg on the cover and redundant, just given the cover of the Crash album, which I interpreted as a Cronenberg reference to that film, like with the title and just with the her presenting herself in this very sexual way on the hood of a crashed car.
I think we're going to look back at this album as a very important album in her career. And I'm impressed that she didn't fall into the musician trope that has taken down acts like Guns N' Roses. If you remember Chinese Democracy and how it took Axl Rose like 15 years to make that album, even Trent Reznor after The Downward Spiral took him 5 years to make The Fragile. I'm glad she didn't fall into that trap and just put an album out, kind of released the tension in the air about her post-Brat era, and she can move on musically.
Totally. And also reassuring to know that her number one goal isn't retaining the Brat audience or pandering to that audience. I feel like this is an album for people that liked her music before Brat.
I don't know. Has she said if she's going to tour this album?
She is touring this album.
Interesting.
Yeah. Also, I just want to say, I really appreciate the topics of some of these songs. Like with a song like Card Declined, I like that she's writing a song about consumerism and how hollow that can be.
Right. As she says in Card Decline, let's go shopping. I'll buy a handbag. I'll buy some shoes. I'll buy a smile. I'll buy some jewelry. A personality, a whole backstory. Card declined.
And that's really what buying into certain luxury brands is, right? Like if you're buying into Versace versus Phoebe Philo, you're buying into an identity, a backstory on some level. Again, cool thing to write a song about. Also, Spring Summer 26, a very sad, dark, and very specific song that I interpreted to be about just how it feels to be sitting front row at a fashion show in full glam while all of this horrible shit is going on in the outside world when the future feels incredibly bleak.
This album is much darker than the tone of Brat, but there are callbacks to Brat, like rock music. She talks about how the dance floor is dead, so now we're making rock music, as opposed to club classics on Brat, where she says, I want to dance to me when I go to the club. So she's definitely saying,
like, I want to dance to me.
Me.
Me. Me. When I go to the club. Yes.
I think it is smart of her to, on this album, say that, like, guys, the Brat era is dead, which she has done basically a multimedia campaign between the moment and this album to be like, it's over. We had a great time, summer of 2024.
But if you miss Brat summer, listen to Confessions too.
Absolutely.
All right, guys, I guess we'll go polish off the rest of this bottle.
All right, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.